This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Well, hello there. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're listening to Night Transmissions. If you haven't tuned in before, wouldn't be any big surprise, really. This is only the ninth show. We run old radio shows. We try to stick with the weird ones, the macabre ones, the science fiction ones. The weirder, the better. Tonight I'm going to start off with the British import, The Price of Fear, which has quickly become one of my own favorites. These were done by the BBC in 1974 and starred Vincent Price.
Hello, welcome. This story, which I've called Soul Music, involved me purely by chance. Due to some slight technical failure, the non-stop flight I'd been booked on for filming commitments in Rome was diverted to Paris. And there in the refreshment lounge at Orly Airport, I met up again with Marianne. I spotted her several minutes before she saw me, but the recognition was as immediate as if the intervening years had never been. The same cool, poised awareness, even in that overcrowded, bustling setting. A kind of inner apartness. It would be difficult to describe. It made the frustrations of the flight, even the possibility of an overnight stop, only too worthwhile. The fact that her husband, the international violinist David Clementis, was bound to be traveling with her, in music circles they had long been nicknamed the Inseparables, offered the opportunity of a double treat.
Oh, my dear Vincent, it's sweet of you to say so.
Some green.
Thank you.
Well, then, out with it. How's the maestro?
Oh, David's fine.
Well, more to the point, where's the maestro? Well, let's face it, the old crowd always referred to the two of you as the Inseparables.
Inseparable? Oh, yes. Yes, they did, didn't they?
Now, don't tell me. You've got him lurking underneath the table, Stradivarius tuned and at the ready. Well, what's it to be, romance or a touch of ochichonia?
Well, David came on ahead, an earlier flight.
Oh?
Well, no, nothing mysterious. Party business agents, an impresario, well, you know the whirl. Besides, he's never appeared in this particular hall before, and in violin circles it's got a reputation as a dead house. He suddenly got a bit jittery about the acoustics.
Typical David.
Huh?
Well, always the perfectionist.
Yes. Yes, he was, wasn't he?
Marianne, you all right?
Yeah, well, I'm fine. I'm just a bit tired, but I'm fine.
Global Air have agreed to announce the cancellation of their flight 108 to Rome. Passengers are requested to report to the inquiry desk for details of overnight accommodation and alternative bookings for the continuation of their journey.
Well, that settles it, doesn't it?
Mesdames,
well, what could be nicer? A night on the town in gay Paris, all courtesy of good old Global Air. To begin with, you can wangle me a ticket for the maestro's concert. Even if it does mean swinging from one of the chandeliers.
Oh, but
I insist. And afterwards, I'll come backstage, whisk him away from the backslappers, and carry the pair of you off to a secret little bistro I've been saving in Montmartre. Food before decor. And just the three of us.
Oh, but surely, if you've got an early morning flight to catch...
Marianne, is anything the matter? It's almost as though you'd rather I stayed well clear.
No, it's nothing, really. Nothing in the world. It's really wonderful seeing you again.
You think the same will go for David?
David? Well, of course. Why should it be otherwise?
My ticket for the concert was waiting for me at the box office, as promised. The attendant handed it across coolly. No, almost contemptuously. I'd expected some kind of covering note from either Marianne or David, but there was none. I passed through the heavy velvet curtains and stood at the back of the circle. There was no usher to examine my ticket, but then there seemed little need. At a generous estimate, I reckon, the whole house could have been moved forward and still barely fill the front three rows. Their mild enthusiasm proved premature. Sufficient to say the performance was a travesty. The adverse notices completely justified. But it wasn't until the interval, grateful for my oversized cognac in the crush bar, that I tried to grasp the cause, the reason for what I'd just witnessed. I settled for one word, contempt. Contempt on the part of the soloist. It summed up his attitude and performance exactly. Even visually, the violinist at the center of this indifference was a grotesque of the David Clementis I remembered. The soloist whose charm and superlative talent had won hearts and critical acclaim in every major concert hall in the world. A veritable travesty of the immaculate, assured Clementis whose famous profile even now stared out of the display cases that lined the walls. Contempt. Not only for that fast diminishing audience, but for himself too. But most of all, contempt for that supreme talent that he had nurtured and that they had adulated for so long. But why? In God's name, why? I must have spoken the thought, because suddenly I was aware of Marianne standing beside me, but not the Marianne of the airport. Now she was making no attempt to hide the hurt, the need within her.
I'd hoped you might not come, that they might have found you a place on an earlier flight. But now that you have... Do you think I might have a cognac, too?
Oh, but of course. Au revoir, cognac.
Monsieur...
How long?
What, like this? A year or so after our marriage. In the early days, it seemed our love had made his talent flourish. But it wasn't till the pact had been signed and sealed, so to speak, that I began to notice the change.
But what could have changed him? Why?
No, look, let me ask the question. Now, before I came along, what would you have said with David's one love? The all-consuming passion, the reason for his very existence.
What a strange way to put it.
The reason for his very existence.
Well, I suppose...
No. Don't suppose. Admit it.
All right. His music.
His only love. It had possessed him from the very beginning, exclusively, uncompromisingly. He had no life beyond the rehearsal room or the concert platform. The demands made by this God-given talent was all that he'd known until we met and loved. And I taught him to share my world. Other interests, other people, other places. And therefore, I displaced the total dedication, the exclusiveness of this talent. I broke the absolute stranglehold of whatever power had possessed him before.
Possessed? Why do you use the word possessed?
It's a strong word, isn't it?
Yes.
In the Dark Ages, they applied it to witches and warlocks and burned them at the stake, didn't they?
Mm.
You know, it's a word we hardly ever use now. We prefer to skirt the issue. But the talent David had possessed him as surely and as completely as any demon. The only difference was, in his case, there could be no exorcist. None. God knows we tried. But the talent had exclusive rights, you see. It possessed him from within, his very soul. And when I'm around...
The
long as I'm around, it destroys him from within and leaves him, well, the broken doll that you saw standing there tonight.
You know, Marianne, the ancient Egyptians believed that the soul was a very real, substantial thing, that it had an actual physical location, just like any other organ, the heart, the liver, the spleen. They tried to locate it, to preserve it, to sanctify and deify it in their Coptic jars.
And a couple of thousand years on, and we're only too anxious to deny its very existence. But it's there, all right. In David's case, it's in his hands. The soul talent is locked in his two hands, in the fingers, that through his music can create a heaven or a hell. Not only for himself, but for anyone who dares to interfere with it or displace it. I tried, but I failed.
Failed? But you've done so much for him. How could you have failed?
Well, David admits it, too. Just now you witnessed his public admission. As surely as any warlock suffering from the tortures of the Inquisition, waiting for the fires of hell to be lit and the agonies of hell to begin.
But if what you say is true...
Well, I know it to be. That's why I'm leaving him, Vincent.
Leaving him?
Don't you understand? I have no choice. I can't watch the doll dance. Not once, but over and over again. Open to the scorn and contempt of anyone who chooses to pay the price of admission. I can't afford to pay the price of admission anymore.
You desert him to this force?
It's his only chance. It's a fair exchange. My misery for the price of his salvation.
Well, I'd better get out.
No, don't go back. You needn't. He doesn't know you're here.
And if he did?
I know he'd not expect it.
But of course I'd damn well expect it, my love. A straightforward case of rally round the flag, isn't it, Vincent? Old buddy.
Oh, you know, David.
Mark you, the ralliers are lying a bit thin on the ground this season, but then that's only to be expected, isn't it? Well, damn you, isn't it?
Darling, there's no need.
There's every need. Dear. Yeah, dear, the well seems to have run dry.
I'll ring through.
Well, the bar will be closed, but I'm sure if you were to try using your personal charms... Please, Marianne.
Very well, David.
You know we're splitting up, Marianne and myself. She told you we were?
Yes, David, she told me.
Yes, of course she did. But she probably told you it was her idea, not mine. A supreme personal sacrifice in the cause of art.
Something like that.
Not true. It was my idea. My decision.
I see.
Well, do you think I'd honestly swap a single moment of my life with Marianne for the existence I knew before? For what now must take its place?
I don't know.
Well, take my word for it.
But, David, you still have the choice.
No choice. For Marianne's sake, you see, living with me is just not safe any longer. This force inside me is just not safe.
Why don't you try telling me about it?
There have been several occasions, incidents.
I don't think I understand.
It's quite simple. A desire to hurt, to inflict. At first, simply with a gesture, a word, until...
Go on, David, tell me.
Until, in London, about a month ago, there'd been a reception after the concert. Marianne was tired and came back early to the hotel. I remember getting back myself in the early hours of the morning. I went into the bedroom. I watched her sleeping there. And then suddenly my hands. God. My hands about her throat. Possessed. With a will, a volition, all of their own, pressing harder, harder, until, just as suddenly, it stopped. No hate anymore, only remorse. Remorse and the decision that it should never happen again, ever again. But it's still there, you see. In the hands. A force over which there can be no control.
And the alternative, if you choose not to accept it, not to release it?
Pain, certainly. And perhaps, ultimately, a hell beyond anything man has ever known. As the soul fights the body to get free, and the body fights back to imprison it. A pain of tearing. As the soul tries to get out.
For what seemed an eternal moment, my friend studied the frail eloquence of his hands holding the tumbler. Then, with an inner force that seemed totally their own, they jerked convulsively. The crystal tumbler lay in 1,000 razor-edged splinters at his feet. That, as it turned out, was to be my last meeting with David. And the next day, I flew on to Rome. But I did hear from Marianne. We'd just finished some location sequences at a small fishing village when her letter arrived. There'd been a long delay in its forwarding. The postmark, Paris, a good month earlier. I opened it with an almost positive conviction of what I would find.
I know what a shock this will be to you. David collapsed as soon as we got back to the hotel that night. By the time we got him to the hospital, there was nothing to be done. You will see from one of the clippings, the jury at the coroner's hearing recorded an open verdict. But I think we... Anyway, though only too well, there was a very real, if inexplicable, cause. Let it remain our secret. The price David paid for his unique talent was finally exacted in full, and in a manner so bizarre I find it impossible to embark on here. But if the final awful proof should interest you, and you are returning via Paris, please ring me at this number, and I will arrange a meeting with Dr. Emile Fouchard. I have already told him he may expect to hear from us, and that he is to hold nothing, I repeat, nothing, back. We owe you this. Besides, to know is to share. Marianne.
To know is to share. But to know what? To share what? What was it that eventually persuaded me to do exactly as Marianne asked? To ring her number, arrange an appointment, and finally find myself seated in the good doctor's surgery come consulting room, just off the Rue Madeleine.
To hold nothing back. It's easily said, monsieur. But where does the knowing end and the disbelief begin?
Vincent, you have the right to know.
Well, the simple facts and findings related to my friend's death, they might prove as good a starting point as any.
The simple facts, eh? Eh bien, so be it. Here it is. As presented in testimony at the coroner's court, for which there is allowed no room for speculation or error. A summary of these facts, then. Several witnesses of your friend's collapse in the foyer of his hotel, his admission to the Hôpital de la Vierge on the Île de la Cité, the inescapable fact that he was pronounced dead on arrival, the admitting physician diagnosed heart failure, brought about by blood clotting, brought about by an excessive consumption of alcohol.
I see.
And so I thought, did I?
I'm sorry?
I suspect that Madame omitted to inform you that during his stay in Paris, I acted as her late husband's physician.
No, it's true. I finally managed to persuade David he might benefit from some kind of treatment.
My initial examination of the patient was thorough and exhaustive. I gave it as my considered opinion that the root cause of Monsieur Clémenti's malady was mental rather than physical, which is why I used all my influence to be allowed to assist at the postmortem. Vindication, vanity, call it what you will. Eventually it was achieved. Have you ever witnessed a postmortem, monsieur?
Oh, no, no.
Then if you are not of an over-squeamish disposition, I shall attempt to enlighten you. To begin with, then, to the casual observer, it is more an object lesson in butchery than surgery. Rather the slaughterhouse than the operating theater. The instruments we employ, for the most part anyway, might be purchased in any quincaillerie, hardware shop, you know. The ultimate object of the exercise is to arrive at the vital organs, the brain, heart, the lungs, the stomach and its contents, with the maximum of efficiency and the minimum of subtlety.
Yes, I understand.
To this end, then, hacksaw and cold chisel for the removal of the cranium cap, the ribs and the sternum, a scoop for the removal of the brain, a butcher's knife for passing out the heart sac, the stomach and lung cavities. Some fresh air, perhaps.
Thank you.
A butcher's trade. So much offal to be removed, examined, disposed of, and then replaced with sufficient stuffing material as will persuade the bereaved relatives that their dear departed is as complete and unsullied as when he first came into our charge.
And as a result of this butchery?
We found nothing. Positively nothing that in any way affected my original opinion that the person I'd examined in this office not so many days before was as fit as anyone of his age, constitution, and occupation could be expected to be. Hello. Cause of death? Inconclusive. Consequence?
An open verdict.
And duly recorded for anyone to read.
Well, then what's the mystery?
Occurrences. Yes. Let us call them occurrences. The nature and reason for which we can only speculate.
Go on.
The cadaver of your late friend was placed in one of the wall cabinets with which every dissecting room is equipped. A kind of container, you understand, large enough to accommodate a corpse, but otherwise similar to the kind of filing cabinet you'd find among any office furnishing.
Yes, I understand.
I felt sure you would.
Well, and then?
The cabinet was locked.
Locked? Is that customary?
As I explained at the time to Madame, reserved mainly for celebrities, in view of the current excessive curiosity of the popular press. Just a precaution, you understand.
Yes.
On the very next day, a complaint from Monsieur Corbeau, the artist, was delivered by hand. The very next day.
Corbeau? But where does Corbeau come
into
it?
Well, David had long ago agreed that Corbeau should one day be allowed to make a cast of his hands.
Oh.
But it was a long-standing, well, a life-standing agreement. When he read of David's death, he asked if I now had any reason to refuse that request.
And?
Well, no reason. In fact, it gave me a kind of comfort, a memento for posterity.
Doctor, you said Corbeau made a complaint.
Yes, within hours of the remains being put at his disposal.
I still have his letter, Vincent. Well, perhaps you'd like to read it for yourself.
Macabre, grotesque, satanic, defilement. But what does he mean?
In that, too, you must judge for yourself. But first, I must stress that at no time not right up until the locking of the cabinet, had we dissected or performed any pathological examination on the hands of the deceased. We had no reason to. They would have told us nothing. Some photographs. These, taken before the cabinet was locked.
Yes, I see. Palm to palm. Total repose.
And these, taken immediately after the complaint of Monsieur Kobo had been received.
To know is to share, Vincent.
You'd never have recognized them for hands. They'd been severed. No, they'd been torn away from the rest of the limb. Each joint cracked, the flesh bloated and pistulated, as though all the time, during the hell-like ritual of that post-mortem, as the surgeon butchers went about their casual ritual of carving, hacking, and scooping, the living soul captured within was screaming for escape. A living hell. To lie on a marble slab, eyes expressionless, unblinking, tongue mute, grotesquely protruding through the cavern of the larynx, simply lying there, knowing it, experiencing it, waiting only for the tortures of the hell to stop, for the chance finally to break free, and for the soul music to begin. To know is to share. I made my way back to the hotel. It was raining. At a corner, a street musician sawed forlornly away on his violin. He seemed surprised at the charity I dropped into his cap. But there was no joy in the tune he played.
That was Vincent Price bringing you The Price of Fear. Also starring in soul music was Coral Brown, with John Graham, Roger Snowden, and Michael Burnington. Soul music was first recounted and dramatized by William Ingram and produced by John Dias.
Next up is an episode from the Hall of Fantasy called The Steps That Follow Me. It originally aired on September 19th of 1952.
Come with me, my friend. We shall descend the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Steps That Follow Me.
How did he come to get that name?
Because people around here have seen him at night.
But he's dead.
That's right, he's dead. And they've seen him walking.
It must be their imagination.
Ain't their imaginations, I know. I've seen him myself.
What are you trying to do? Frighten us?
I ain't trying to frighten you, none. I'll have to. You frighten old Mr. Thomas, the death that walks. Because he'll come for you. He's coming for you.
I have before me the diary of a dead man. He and his wife were my best friends. The words he has written down tell a tale so fantastic it's almost impossible to believe. Yet I know that Bill and Helen Mason lived the last few months of their lives in dread fear of the slow steps that followed them. It is late evening as I read his words. I have come to their house, now so empty, and sit in the large, overstuffed leather chair in the library. Outside, rain pummels against the side of the house, The wind blows the fall leaves from the trees, and the sound of thunder gives vent to the anger of the storm. There's something in the house. A tension. A fear, perhaps. I feel almost as if unseen eyes were watching me. As if someone is here with me. Here in this room. And so I stopped to read his diary. Living words from the pen of a man who sleeps forever. March 3rd. Today, Helen and I came across one of those delightful old southern mansions. We decided to stop and make a study of the place. And Helen was especially interested in taking some color pictures to illustrate our lecture series in the fall. Well, I guess no one will mind if we take a look around the place.
No, I'm sure they wouldn't. Oh, it's a shame that whoever owns the house and grounds lets the place run down this way. It must have been beautiful in its day.
Yeah, I imagine it was, Helen. The house could still be saved, renovated. Beautiful place.
Oh, wait a minute. I'd like to get a shot from here. Hmm. If that turns out, it'll make a nice picture.
Helen?
Mm-hmm?
I wonder what that building is over there.
Where?
Right over there, just in back of the house.
Oh, well, no, it's established. Why don't we take a look?
All right, let's do. I can't understand why anyone would let the grounds and house deteriorate so.
Well, it must have cost a lot of money to run a place as large as this, darling. The real estate office probably couldn't find a buyer.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And then the other building doesn't seem to be so run down.
No. In remarkably fine condition. It must have been built a lot later than the house. Seems to be made of stone. Gray stone.
I wonder what it's used for.
I don't know. Actually, I believe that someone lived in the old house not too long ago, and I think probably the second building was constructed during that time.
Well, it's a crime to let a beautiful old place run down like this.
Mm. Well, here we are.
Still?
Yes, dear?
It doesn't have any windows.
Yes, I noticed that. Seems rather strange. Oh, well, maybe it was used for a store.
Oh, look at the door.
Well, what's the matter with it?
I think the lock's broken.
Yeah, you're right.
Why don't you take a look inside?
All right. The lock's all rusted, too. There. Now, that does it.
And now to see what's inside.
Well, there might not be any windows, but there's a skylight that lets in the sun. Come on, let's go in.
All right. Ooh. How cool.
So I noticed. Helen,
what's there in the center of the floor?
That's just what I was going to say. This isn't a storehouse by any stretch of the imagination. It's a mausoleum. That thing in the center of the floor is a sarcophagus. Stone coffin.
There's nothing else in here. Just that. That thing in the center. And yet I feel as if it's crowded. As if there are things here that we can't see.
Oh, that's nonsense, darling. Hey, look, notice how the sun falls across the head of the sarcophagus.
Look, oh, I wonder if we're light enough to take a picture.
Well, I doubt it, but it's a good try.
Well, I might as well if it turns out.
Yeah.
Oh.
What are you two doing in here?
We noticed the lock was broken, and so we came on in.
You shouldn't have done that.
Why not? We didn't do any harm.
I'm sure of that, but he won't like it.
Who won't like it?
The thing that sleeps in that stone coffin.
What are you talking about?
That's what it said. You didn't notice the writing over the door when you came in, did you?
What writing?
You didn't notice it then. That's a shame. Because you didn't know what you were getting into.
Getting into? Look, I'm sorry, but I just don't understand. We didn't hurt anything. We're not intending to steal anything.
Well, that don't make no difference. He doesn't care what your reasons were.
Who is... Who?
They called him Mr. Thomas when he was living. They called him the... Death that walked. Now that he's dead.
The death that walks? Well, how did he come to get that name?
Because people around here have seen him at night.
But he's dead.
That's right, he's dead. And they've seen him walking.
That must be their imagination.
It ain't their imagination. I know. I've seen him myself.
What are you trying to do? Frighten us?
I ain't trying to frighten you, none. I don't have to. He'll frighten you. Old Mr. Thomas.
The death of Walt.
I think we'd better go there.
You don't believe what I'm telling you. That's all right with me. I don't care what you believe, but you listen to what I'm saying now. If I was you, I'd get away from here as fast as I could. Not just from this place, but from the town, this part of the country.
What?
Won't they tell you a little of the story?
Yes.
All right. Maybe you believe me then. Old Tarnish came here from someplace in Europe. I say old, but he really wasn't old. Just seemed that way. He bought the house and grounds here and had them cleaned up. So the place looked like it was brand new. And he started building it they're built. There's something funny about Tarnish, something in his eyes that make you frightened of him. His eyes, they looked like the eyes of a dead man. He didn't act like anyone I ever knew. He was always talking about death. Always telling me he could come back after death. I was a caretaker then, just like I am now. After this building was completed, I used to watch him at night when he'd come out here. It seemed like he was in some sort of a trance. He'd stay out here for hours. And when he'd come back to the house, his eyes would glisten and shine. So you couldn't hardly look at him. A week before he died, he told me that as long as I lived, I was to take care of this place. Because if I didn't, he'd come back and kill me. And then he died. Just like that. He was put in here, in his coffin. And one night, about 2 months later, when the moon was full, I heard a noise. And when I come out to look, I saw the door to this place open and him come out in the moonlight. I could hear his footsteps. It sounded queer and hollow-like. I turned around and I could see his face in the moonlight. Pale and pasty, sick-looking. And those eyes of his seemed like two burning coals of fire. He seemed to be looking at me. I heard him say, "They have disturbed me, and the moon has awakened me. I shall follow them." That's what he said. And I heard it just as plain as you're hearing me. And then he vanished in the night. Towards morning, I heard his footsteps again. And I heard that big iron door closing. And I knew he was back. The next day in town, I heard that Alf Cummins had died the night before, screaming something about not meaning to go into the mausoleum. I knew who killed him.
And that's all there is to the story?
Well, that's just part of it. It's happened again and again in the last 10 years since he's been dead. Folks around here say he'll follow you wherever you go if you come inside here.
Well, in that case, why haven't you been killed?
Because he needs me. He ain't gonna kill me. But if I was you, I'd get out of this part of the country just as soon as I could.
Let's go back to the hotel, Bill.
Yeah, that's all right, dear.
You gonna get away from here?
Yes, we'd better get going.
I wish I'd been here when you come, but I was in town getting this lock. You can't go around leaving this door unlocked. Yeah. That ought to satisfy.
There's an inscription there.
Yeah, that's the writing I mean.
It's got a nice sentiment, ain't it?
If you enter here, into the realm of death, I shall follow you and bring him with me. March 3rd, later. I sit here and write these words. Quite late, and the moon has risen full in the sky. Helen is standing by the window looking out. For some reason, I am frightened. And yet I know that a few months from now, I shall only laugh at the memory of my fright. However, in the morning, I do believe that we will leave this place.
Help you?
Yeah, for tonight at least. I think we'll be leaving tomorrow, Helen.
Oh, I'm glad. I don't believe the caretaker story, and yet I'm afraid.
Yeah. Ah, it's a beautiful night.
Yes, isn't it? That moon's so big and full that it could... Bill.
Yes, dear?
Look down there at the street. There's a man down there.
Oh, there's nothing to be...
Bill! He's looking straight up at us. And pointing to us at... Look at his face, Bill. Look at his face.
Pale. Pasty looking. And his eyes... Two burning coals of fire.
You are listening to the tale of The Steps That Follow Me. As I read these pages, the words stare up at me, and their formations bring to life a nameless terror which I feel all around me. Outside, the storm still rages. Yet the sound of it fades from my mind as the terror in the pages of the volume I hold before me becomes increasingly apparent. March 3rd. Still later. The man down in the street, whomever he was, left after about 10 minutes. He has given us quite a fright.
There are felt any doubts as to whether or not we should leave this place. They've all been dispelled now. Helen has just gone to bed. I think I shall do the same.
If we're going to leave in the morning, you'd better get to sleep, Bill. I want to get out of here as soon as I can.
Yes, I was just coming to bed, Helen.
That man you saw...
Yes?
It might be only coincidence.
Do you really believe that, Helen? Are you trying to talk yourself into it?
I guess I'm trying to rationalize it. I'm afraid I'm not doing a very good job of it.
Well, I don't know what to believe. It could be coincidence, but... somehow I'm afraid it isn't.
Then you think...
Maybe. Now, don't worry about it, Helen. By tomorrow, we'll be several hundred miles from here. And I doubt if whomever it was will follow us.
Sorry. They sound just like the steps that... caretaker described to us.
Yes, but we saw him walk away.
He didn't know he was in the room upstairs.
Well, probably someone else.
No, I know it's not.
All right. Just a minute. I'll call the desk. This is William Mason in 316. Can you tell me who has the room directly above mine? The clerk's going to check. Yes? Oh, I see. No, thank you very much.
What did the clerk say?
The room directly above ours is unoccupied. March 4th. We left the hotel a short time after we heard the steps. We went immediately to our car and drove all night and all day. And are stopping now in a motel almost 1,000 miles away. It's reassuring to know that he could not possibly follow us. I am very tired. Go to bed and get an early start in the morning. Helen, you asleep?
No.
What are you thinking about?
The words that were written above the mausoleum door. If you enter here into the realm of death, I shall follow you and bring him with me.
I hear them, too.
He couldn't possibly have come this far, could he?
I don't know. What's the matter?
Your face. Pressed against the window.
It's not there now.
I was there for just a few seconds. I saw it, Bill. The same man we saw last night outside the hotel. He was right outside the window.
March 5th. This morning when I went in to pay the bill... the man who owns the motel said a strange, pasty-faced man had been in earlier and told him to tell me that he would follow me. March 11th. It's impossible to get any material together that'll help me in my work. Everywhere we go, he's there also.
March 16th. Yeah, Mr. Mason, this guy said it was all right for you to go on ahead because he was going to follow you.
seconds.
No, he didn't leave a name. He just said that he'd be in touch with you.
April 7th.
Never saw anyone who looked like that before. Be a friend of yours, Mr. Mason?
April 18th.
He said he'd follow you.
April 29th.
Told me to say he'd follow you.
May 15th.
Follow you.
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 I wish there was something I could do, Helen, but there's nothing. I've done my best, Rosen, but I can't.
I want to go home, Bill.
Oh, if we go home, it'll be the same thing.
Maybe. Maybe it won't. I can't stand this anymore.
All right, darling. We'll leave for home right away. June 23rd. We arrived home this evening. I called Gary as soon as I could. He said he'd be out within the hour to see us. He wasn't able to help us in any way. I really didn't expect any help. I was hoping that he might be able to offer some concrete suggestion as to what to do. However, last night was the first night in months that we haven't been aware of his presence. Maybe Helen is right. Perhaps he won't follow us here. July 3rd. We've not seen or heard anything unusual since we first came home. I feel as a man might feel who has been given a new lease on life. July 10th. Still nothing. August 19th. For the past 2 months, a feeling of peace and security has enveloped the house. Helen and I have been able to go around with no sense of danger nor of dread. But last night, that feeling was shattered. Gary had come out for dinner. It was almost 10 o'clock.
Well, it's about time for me to get along.
Oh, it's only 10, Gary. Sure, you don't have to go so soon.
I'm afraid I must, Helen. Tomorrow's a working day for me.
I thought I might be able to get you into a game of chess.
Oh, some other time, Bill.
Well, next time, don't stay away so long.
Don't worry. I think we ought to... Tell me, is someone upstairs?
No.
Listen.
He's back.
Who's back?
The man we told you about. Those are his footsteps. I'd know them anywhere. I should. I've heard them enough.
What are you going to do?
Look, will you come upstairs with me, Gary?
Yes, of course.
You stay here, Helen.
Don't go up there, Bill. Don't let him, Gary.
No, Helen. This time I'm going to meet him face to face.
And I'm going with you.
No, you're not. You're going to stay right here. Ready, Gary?
Yes.
Okay, let's go.
Careful.
As careful as we can.
If he is up there, what are you going to do?
I don't know. We'll find that out when the time comes. Our steps came from the guest room.
I don't hear anything.
Well, let's see if he's in there. Stand back, Gary. I'm going to open the door.
Right.
It's empty. There's no one in here.
But I heard someone up here.
Yes, he was here, but he's gone. I can feel it when he's near me. I know that... Come on.
Helen!
Helen, where are you? Helen!
There she is. In the front room.
Helen. What's the matter, Helen? Helen, answer me.
She can't feel. She's sitting there with her eyes wide open.
August 23rd. We buried her today. As I sit here in the empty house writing this, I know that Thomas will come for me too. I am writing this in the hope that someone will find it, read it, and maybe understand my death. It's lonely here. Yet suddenly I have the feeling that I'm not alone. Someone is here with me. right here in this room with me. I'm afraid to turn and meet him. Have those eyes of his burning into me. And yet I must. I pray that someone reads this. Perhaps he will. He will.
I have read the manuscript in full. The August 23rd entry was the last he ever made. The feeling of creeping horror that runs through the pages has imparted itself to me. And I sense that someone is here with me. Of course, I realize that it's only my imagination. But I can't shake that feeling. There is someone here.
Characters and events portrayed on this program are fictional, and any resemblance to actual persons living or dead or to actual events is purely coincidental. Featured on this program were Carl Grayson as William Mason, Eloise Cover as Helen Mason, Richard Thorne as Gary, and Sam Siegel as the caretaker. Original music moods were created and performed by Harold Turner. These programs are directed by Leroy Olinger, written and produced by Richard Thorne. Your announcer is George Bauer. This program came from Chicago.
Exploring Tomorrow was a fairly short-lived series. It ran in part of 1957 and 1958. When this particular episode ran, I'm not sure. Anyway, compared to X-1, Exploring Tomorrow does come off as a rather low-rent version, but it's fun. And if you're at all hip to science fiction, you'll recognize the name John W. Campbell. He was one of the great editors of science fiction throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Anyway, I'm going to get out of the way. Here's the story now. Jeez, did I really say hip to science fiction? My bad.
Exploring Tomorrow.
And now, here is your guide to these adventures of the mind, John Campbell.
The term genius is fairly common in our language today. I wonder how many of you realize that the term originated with the old Arabian Nights concept of the genie. You know, the magical creature that came in a bottle and had such wonderful powers. The story is about a whole planet of geniuses. Genie. Interesting people to try to enslave, you know. Laboratory scientists have as much fun as anybody else, you know. One of the laboratory laws, sometimes called Finagle's Law or Murphy's Law, goes, in any laboratory experiment, if something can go wrong, it will. Well, this is the story of a planet-sized laboratory experiment in which something could go wrong.
Professor, I am to His Excellency Marshal Gorham. The ship is now in orbit about the planet of destination.
Good. Good. Have a lifeboat prepared for descent with an invisibility screen.
Yes, Your Excellency. How many crewmen will you want to take along?
None. There'll be just myself and you, Professor Heim.
Sir, you, the Marshal, landing on a barbarian world without even an escort, And begging your pardon, sir, but...
Do you mean that the Grand Marshal of the Galactic Imperial Armed Forces can't carry out an undercover inspection on a backward planet without a dozen Marines clanking in his wake?
No, sir. No, sir.
And please remember that the people down there have no weapon more powerful than a bow and arrow. Whereas I will be carrying a nuclear blaster under my coat.
Yes, sir. Of course, Your Excellency.
And while we are down there on that planet, Professor Heim, stand by for possible action. We may have to bombard the place with cobalt missiles. Wipe all the life off it.
Sterilize the entire planet, sir?
You heard me, Professor. I said we may have to. Not that we will. It depends on what I find down there. That peaceful, primitive world may turn out to be just another stupid scientific experiment. Or it may turn out to be the worst danger the Empire and all its stars have faced for 1,000 years. Now, I want you, Professor. I'm in my office at once. Over.
Yes, Your Excellency. Over and out.
Oh, there you are, Professor Heim.
Yes, Marshal Gorham, here I am.
You've arrived at your experimental planet.
I know. I was just watching it float there among the constellations. I don't know a more beautiful sight in the universe.
Well, break out the native costumes for us, too. We're going down.
What?
I am a military man, Professor, not one of your psychologists. Now, so far, your people have spent 1,500 years studying that planet. But as for me, there's war on the Imperial borders, and I can spare 3 days.
3 days to decide?
To decide whether we can let your experiment go on or whether to discontinue it, shall I say?
But only 3 days? Marshal, you don't realize that it would take a week just to explain the statistics of...
I know, I've heard it all. 1,500 years ago, the Psychological Research Foundation decided to learn what makes human history tick by running controlled experiments. So it took a lot of uninhabited planets and put different kinds of people on them.
Oh, their memories wiped out, Marshal. The first generation started out knowing as little as animals. They had to discover everything for themselves. Fire, language, the wheel. Do you imagine that their descendants could have learned enough to menace us? To threaten an empire that for 3,000 years has controlled millions of planetary systems?
We've been through all this before, Hyam. I've told you again and again, I'm not worried about your other experimental worlds. They're still cavemen or less. But this planet here, pure genius stock, a planet where nobody has an IQ below 150, and God knows how high they go. Well, I just can't tell about them. And His Majesty is worried, too. There have been rumors. He sent me here himself to decide whether or not those rumors could be true.
But people down there don't even know the Galactic Empire exists. Why, the men there are still farming with plows and sailing in steamships.
Oh, sure, sure, one of it. Ordinary men on Earth with an average IQ of 100 needed maybe 500,000 years to get as far as your geniuses have in 1,500. I understand they've already developed Newtonian physics, chemical batteries, telescopes, world governments. At that rate, they'll be visiting the other planets of this system in 50 years. They'll reach the stars in a century, and then they'll be loose in the Galactic Empire. Do you think they'd fit tamely into the caste system, like good subjects of the Emperor? Why, they couldn't even if they tried. They'd produce a new invention and a new philosopher every day. And that would mean the end of stability, and that, Professor, would mean the end of the Empire.
So you say, but you're a soldier. You don't understand.
Yes, I know. I'm a dirty militarist who can't see past the end of my own guns. All I'm good for is killing, huh? And you're a noble intellectual scientist.
Yeah.
I've heard that guff before, Professor, and I've gotten pretty tired of it.
But I tell you, the genius people are cooperative in that.
My orders are to inspect the place and decide for myself whether they're right or not. So that's what I'm going to do. Come along, Hein.
Exploring Tomorrow continues in just a moment. When driving, luck can stay with you for years. But on the road, it can leave you in a split second, a tragic split second. So drive carefully. You will live longer, and you will arrive alive.
There's been considerable discussion of what constitutes good and evil over the last few millenniums. But, you know, there's an interesting comment someone made. I don't know where it did originate. Melodrama is the conflict between good and evil. And tragedy is the conflict between good and good. When two good men, each with a good point to make, get into conflict, that's where real tragedy starts.
Professor. I've got the lifeboat into the atmosphere and leveled off. So where do I head now? I'm. Wake up, you wool-headed dreamer.
I'm sorry, Marshal. I was thinking, looking out the porthole and thinking.
What about?
How lovely the sky is. So blue. And the land below, mountains and forests and hopeful young farms.
Oh, no, a poet yet. Well, I'm thinking about my job of inspection. Where shall we go?
Fly north, northeast for 700 kilometers and you'll find this planet's largest city. It's also the capital of the world government.
That'll do. I should be able to observe a pretty good cross-section of the genius race.
Do you seriously believe you can decide the fate of an entire world on the basis of what you see in one city? How do you expect to learn anything even there? You don't speak any of the local languages, not even the international one that developed.
You'll talk for both of us. We're claimed to be visitors from a long ways off, the opposite hemisphere. We'll just wander around town for a couple of days, and I'll get the feel of the place.
You mean you decide whether these people live or die just on the basis of a hunch?
Now, here we are. Landed in an empty meadow. You sure nobody will happen by?
Well, what do they do? The lifeboat is invisible.
Even so. Well, we don't want the genius people learning the truth, do we, Professor?
Well, of course not. On that, you and I do agree. But my own motive is that I don't want to spoil the experiment.
Come on, let's get moving. We'll have to hike into the city. Nice outdoors. Sunshine. I don't know when I last breathed air that didn't come out of a tank.
And you turn all this into black radioactive ash.
Come on, I said, let's start walking. Well, there's a road. It's pretty well paved.
Oh, yes. 10 years ago, this was a livestock trail. Today, they're driving steam automobiles over it. I predict that 10 years from now, the first airplane will use this for a landing strip.
But where's the mass market to support all that progress?
There isn't much of one. Actually, most people here are still riding around in buggies. You see, they have a unique social system. The average man on this planet would rather buy a new book than a new gadget. But at the same time, their engineers keep on making inventions because a mind of such power can't help being creative.
And I tell you, the Empire can't afford what you call creativeness. So this is their biggest city.
Right. There are about 1 million people in it.
You call that a city?
Considering the small population of this world, yes.
It's backward, all right. Carts pulled by animals. Water pumped by windmills. Bearded men in clothes of vegetable fiber. Wood and plaster houses. Gas lamps.
That's what I keep telling you, Marshal. These people aren't demons. They're as human as you and I. They're born the same way as us. Grow up, learn, love, laugh, weep, and die like human beings anywhere in all space and time. They simply happen to be more intelligent. Let them live.
70 generations ago, they were savages. They didn't even know how to chip a flint. And now they've come to this.
Yes. Our observers mingling with them in disguise have already learned more about historical dynamics than...
Oh, sure, this city is still primitive. But in another 100 years, they have schools, laboratories. They don't frown on artists and scientists and philosophers. They glorify them. So, in 100 years, they'll be out among the stars. And we don't dare allow that.
But they won't, Marshal. Not necessarily. If only you'd let me show you the economic data. For instance, the great uninhabited spaces they still have right on their home planet.
Shut up. I'm thinking.
Thinking? I doubt if you're able to.
What did you say?
Nothing.
I have a knife, Grand Marshal Gorham. You don't know that, do you? You think I'm just another ineffectual little dreamer, don't you? Well, you may find out different.
If by militarist we mean someone who believes that it is necessary to use physical force to carry out, to implement a theory, a belief, then it looks to me like Professor Heim He has become a militarist. He intends to use force, doesn't he?
Hello, to Solar. Heard that?
Saban Hosted.
What did he say, that bellhop or whatever he was?
He wished us good night in the international language. He thinks we're foreigners, you remember?
If he only knew how foreign.
That's a cheap way to feel superior, isn't it?
Oh, shut up, Heim. I'm still trying to decide what to do about this planet. There are too many paradoxes. The waiter in the restaurant wanted to ask you about the ethnology of the country he thought we came from. This is a nice, clean hotel room, but it doesn't have running water. And yet the clerk downstairs was reading what I swear must have been a mathematical journal.
Does that make them monsters? Under the social system here, such routine jobs are done by students. And, of course, every person on this planet goes through at least 5 years of college. But that's all that amounts to, Gorham.
A whole world of long-haired dreamers who are experimenting with aircraft and rockets, who developed the theory of evolution before they learned how to smelt iron. I don't trust them.
Of course, you don't understand them. You're too... I mean...
Too stupid? Isn't that what you're going to say, Professor? I'm just a dumb militarist who worked his way from private soldier to Grand Marshal of the Galactic Empire. No fine scientist, just a hired hand keeping the barbarian raiders off your scientific back. Well, Professor Heim, I happen to be the man who will decide what's to become of this planet of geniuses.
And have you decided yet, Your Excellency?
Not yet. I can still take a couple of days to...
2 more days? After the foundation work of 1,500 years?
Wait. What are you doing?
This is a knife in my hand, Marshal Gorham. Don't move. If you reach for that blaster, I'll kill you.
You're going crazy, Heim?
No. You're the crazy one. You're the lunatic who would blood out man's last best hope, this planet. You allow yourself 3 days to decide the whole future of a world. You unbuckle that blaster. Don't let your hand come near the trigger, or I'll drop it on the floor. Kick it over to me. So. Now I've got you where I want you.
But, Professor, I haven't decided anything yet. I might decide this experiment is safe. I might still report to the Emperor. There's nothing to be afraid of. He can forget your race.
You might, but I know you won't. I'm going to kill you, Marshal Gorham. I'm going to report to the spaceship captain that you died accidentally. And then I'm going to hope that the next Imperial Inspector will be more reasonable.
Look out! Stand back, you fool! No!
I only stabbed you in the arm that time, Marshal Gorham. But you're in a corner now. I'll get you this time.
Go! Go, Varadan!
Go along, or you don't go along, you rat!
Who's done it, Schulte? Klo! Klo!
You spoke their language. You already know the language of this planet.
Aye. The attendant has the key, of course. He's coming in. Drop that knife, Professor Heim. He's a husky chap.
Shalom, Orna.
Yai. Take la odoret. Drop that knife, I said, Professor.
Yes, of course.
Sit down, Heim. You look more shocked than I am. Kavala nomat, Odan. He's gone after the first aid kit for me. Not that you hurt me seriously.
I'm sorry.
It doesn't matter.
And you're a native of this planet yourself.
Yes. I was born here, though I've lived most of my life out in the Empire.
We thought we were keeping a planet full of geniuses and ignorance. How long have you known?
We began to suspect the truth 500 years ago. And we discovered that all life had evolved from lower forms, but couldn't find a subhuman ancestor for man. And finally, your disguised observers were identified. We even used blind man techniques to spot those wearing invisibility screens. Did you really expect you could go on fooling a race with twice your brain power?
Well, we thought so. Yes, I suppose it was foolish.
Some of us wormed our way into space as stowaways or in disguise, that sort of thing. People here live quietly, so as not to give the show away. We don't tell our children the truth till they're old enough to keep up the pretense. But meanwhile, for the past 300 years, our agents have been out in the Empire, learning everything you know, posing as citizens working up into the key positions of your government. We can do that by sheer merit.
Yes, obviously, you can become Imperial Marshals.
Quite. And when the Emperor got suspicious, he sent me, his trusted soldier, a notorious anti-intellectual, to check up for him. Naturally, I was going to give this planet a clean bill of health, but I had to string you along first to make it look good. Evidently, I put on a better act than I had planned.
And now that I know your secret?
I'll have to report that you were accidentally killed here, Professor. But don't worry. All you have to do is spend the rest of your life here as one of us. I don't think you'll mind that.
Oh, no, not personally. I'd enjoy it. I used to envy the people on this world. But when you, well, your race, I mean, when you've completely taken over the Galactic Empire from within, what do you plan to do?
Well, we'll remodel it, shall I say. I'm afraid you wouldn't understand exactly what we intend to do. It's a little beyond your grasp, but it will be for the benefit of the ordinary galactic citizen, too. The poor, backward, benighted Galactic Empire.
They say that the first requirement for teaching a dog to do tricks is that you have to know more than the dog. If you want to teach a planet full of geniuses to do tricks for you, first make sure you know more than the geniuses. You can enslave some kinds of entities, but you can't enslave, you can't impose on entities who are more intelligent, more thoughtful, more wise than you yourself. What will happen is they'll turn out to be helping you in disguise.
Fascinating adventure in Exploring Tomorrow. Heard in our cast tonight were Ron Dawson and Al Ruscio. Script was by Powell Anderson, produced and directed by Sanford Marshall here in New York. Guy Wallace speaking.
Probably the thing I like most about doing this show is being able to present these LibriVox productions. So far, I'm just using short stories. I have not and probably will not try to serialize a book. Being that these stories are read by amateurs, the readership is less than optimum. Not at all professional like real audio books. But on the other hand, you find things that would never make it into an audio book. Today, I'm going to present Carol M. Capp's short story, All the Earth a Grave. Now, Carol M. Capp is a pseudonym for C.C. McCapp. I should say, rather, that Carol M. Capps is better known as C.C. McCapp, who was born in 1917 and died in 1971, and was active in science fiction during the 60s. This particular story, All the Earth a Grave, was written in 1963, and may seem, well, not really may seem, but actually is a bit dated in its references to the political situation of the time. There's also a reference to beatniks. Had it been written a decade later, the references to the beatniks would have and could have been easily replaced by references to the hippies, and the references to the political situation would have been as valid then as they were in 63, even though they now seem, well, a bit quaint and dated. Still, it's a very amusing take on the consumerism of the 1960s, and may have a lesson or two about how to get out of our current economic difficulties.
And All the Earth a Grave by C.C. McCapp. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This recording is by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. And All the Earth a Grave by C.C. McCapp. There's nothing wrong with dying, it just hasn't ever had the proper sales pitch. It all began when the new bookkeeping machine of a large Midwestern coffin manufacturer slipped a cog, or blew a transistor, or something. It was fantastic that the error, one of two decimal places, should enjoy a straight run of okays, human and mechanical, clear down the line. But when the figures clacked out at the last clacking out station, there it was. The figures were now sacred, immutable, and it is doubtful whether the president of the concern or the chairman of the board would have dared question them, even if either of those two gentlemen had been in town. As for the advertising manager, the last thing he wanted to do was question them. He carried them, they were the budget for the coming fiscal year, into his office, staggering a little on the way, and dropped dazedly into his chair. They showed the budget for his own department as exactly 100 times what he'd been expecting. That is to say, 50 times what he'd put in for. When the initial shock began to wear off, his face assumed an expression of intense thought. In about 5 minutes he leaped from his chair, dashed out of the office with a shouted syllable or two for his secretary, and got his car out of the parking lot. At home, he tossed clothes into a traveling bag and barged towards the door, giving his wife a quick kiss and an equally quick explanation. He didn't bother to call the airport. He meant to be on the next plane east and no nonsense about it. With one thing and another, the economy hadn't been exactly in overdrive that year, and predictions for the Christmas season were gloomy. Early retail figures bore them out. Gift-buying dribbled along feebly until Thanksgiving, despite brave speeches by the administration. The holiday passed more in self-pity than in thankfulness among owners of gift-oriented businesses. Then, on Friday following Thanksgiving, the coffin ads struck. Struck may be too mild a word. People on the streets saw feverishly working crews, at holiday rates, slapping up posters on billboards. The first poster was a dilly. A toothy and toothsome young woman leaned over a coffin she'd been unwrapping. She smiled as if she'd just received overtures of matrimony from an 80-year-old billionaire. There was a Christmas tree in the background, and the coffin was appropriately wrapped. So was she. She looked as if she'd just gotten out of bed, or were ready to get into it. For amorous young men, and some not so young, the message was plain. The motto, "The gift that will last more than a lifetime," seemed hardly to the point. Those at home were assailed on TV with a variety of bright and clever skits of the same import. Some of them hinted that, if the young lady's gratitude were really precipitous, and the bedroom too far away, the coffin might be comfy. Of course, the more settled elements of the population were not neglected. For the older married man, there was a blow directly between the eyes. "Do you want your widow to be half safe?" And for the spinster without immediate hopes, "I dreamt I was caught dead without my virgin form casket." Newspapers, magazines, and every other medium added to the assault, never letting it cool. It was the most horrendous campaign for sheer concentration that had ever battered at the public mind. The public reeled, blinked, shook its head to clear it, gawked, and rushed out to buy. Christmas was not going to be a failure after all. Department store managers who had grudgingly and under strong sales pressure made space for a single coffin somewhere at the rear of the store now rushed to the telephones like toots with a direct pronouncement from a horse. Everyone who possibly could got into the act. Grocery supermarkets put in casket departments. The Association of Pharmaceutical Retailers, who felt they had some claim to priority, tried to get court injunctions to keep caskets out of service stations, but were unsuccessful because the judges were all out buying caskets. Beauty parlors showed real ingenuity in merchandising. Roads and streets clogged with delivery trucks, rented trailers, and whatever else could haul a coffin. The stock market went completely mad. Strikes were declared and settled within hours. Congress was called into session early. The president got authority to ration lumber and other materials suddenly in starvation short supply. state laws were passed against cremation under heavy lobby pressure. A new racket called boxjacking blossomed overnight. The advertising manager who had put the thing over had been fighting with all the formidable weapons of his breed to make his plant managers build up a stockpile. They had, but it went like a toupee in a wind tunnel. Competitive coffin manufacturers were caught napping, but by Wednesday after Thanksgiving, they, along with their original one, were on 24-hour, 7-day basis. Still only a fraction of the demand could be met. Jet passenger planes were stripped of their seats, supplied with Yankee gold, and sent to plunder the world of its coffins. It might be supposed that Christmas goods other than caskets would take a bad dumping. That was not so. Such was the upsurge of prosperity, and such was the shortage of coffins, that nearly everything, with a few exceptions, enjoyed the biggest season on record. On Christmas Eve, the frenzy slumped to a crawl, though on Christmas morning there were still optimists out prowling the empty stores. The nation sat down to breathe. Mostly it sat on coffins because there wasn't space in the living rooms for any other furniture. There was hardly an individual in the United States who didn't have, in case of sudden sharp pains in the chest, several boxes to choose from. As for the rest of the world, it had better not die just now, or it would be literally a case of dust to dust. Of course, everyone expected a doozy of a slump after Christmas. But our advertising manager, who by now was, of course, sales manager and first vice president also, wasn't settling for any boom and bust. He'd been a frustrated victim of his choice of industries for so many years that now, with his teeth in something, he was going to give it the old bite. He gave people a short breathing spell to arrange their coffin payments and move the presents out of the front rooms. Then, late in January, his new campaign came down like a 100 megatonner. Within a week, everyone saw quite clearly that his Christmas models were now obsolete. The coffin became the new status symbol. The auto industry was, of course, demolished. Even people who had enough money to buy a new car weren't going to trade in the old one and let the new one stand out in the rain. The garages were full of coffins. Petroleum went along with autos, though there were those who whispered knowingly that the same people merely moved over into the new industry. It was noticeable that the center of it became Detroit. A few trucks and buses were still being built, but that was all. Some of the new caskets were true works of art. Others, well, there was variety. Compact models appeared, in which the occupant's feet were to be doubled up alongside his ears. One manufacturer pushed a circular model, claiming that by all the laws of nature the fetal position was the only right one. At the other extreme were virtual houses, ornate and lavishly equipped. Possibly the largest of all was the togetherness model, triangular, with graduated recesses for father, mother, 8 children plus 2 playmates, and in the far corner beyond the baby, the cat. The slump was over. Still, economists swore that the new boom couldn't last either. They reckoned without the advertising manager, whose eyes gleamed brighter all the time. People already had coffins, which they polished and kept on display, sometimes in the new coffin ports being added to their houses. The advertising manager's reasoning was direct and to the point. He must get people to use the coffins, and now he had all the money to work with that he could use. The new note was woven in so gradually that it was not easy to put a finger on any one ad and say, "It began here." One of the first was surely the widely printed one, showing a tattooed, smiling young man with his chin thrust out manfully, lying in a coffin. He was rugged-looking and likable, not too rugged for the spindly limb to identify with, and he oozed, even though obviously dead, virility at every pore. He was probably the finest-looking corpse since Richard the Lionhearted. Neither must one overlook the singing commercials. Possibly the catchiest of these, a really cute little thing, was achieved by jazzing up the funeral march. It started gradually, and it was all so unviolent that few saw it as suicide. teenagers began having popping-off parties. Some of their elders protested a little, but adults were taking it up, too. The tired, the unappreciated, the ill, and the heavy-laden lay down in growing numbers and expired. A black market in poisons operated for a little while, but soon pinched out. Such was the pressure of persuasion that few needed artificial aids. The boxes were very comfortable. People just closed their eyes and exited smiling. The beatniks, who had their own models of coffin, moldy, scroungy, and without lids, since the beatniks insisted on being seen, placed their boxes on the Grant Avenue in San Francisco. They died with highly intellectual expressions, and eventually were washed by the gentle rain. Of course, there were many voices shouting, "Calamity!" When aren't there? But in the long run, and not a very long one at that, they availed naught. It isn't hard to imagine the reactions of the rest of the world, so let us imagine a few. The Communist bloc immediately gave its stamp of disapproval, denouncing the movement as a filthy capitalist imperialist pig plot. Red China, who had been squabbling with Russia for some time about a matter of method, screamed for immediate war. Russia exposed this as patent stupidity, saying that if the capitalists wanted to die, warring upon them would only help them. China surreptitiously tried out the thing as an answer to excess population, and found it good. It also appealed to the well-known melancholy facet of Russian nature. Besides, after pondering for several days, the Red Bloc decided it could not afford to fall behind in anything, so it started its own program, explaining with much logic how it differed. An elderly British philosopher endorsed the movement on the grounds that a temporary setback in evolution was preferable to facing up to anything. The Free Bloc, the Red Bloc, the Neutral Bloc, and such scraps as had been too obtuse to find themselves a bloc, were drawn into the whirlpool in an amazingly short time, if in a variety of ways. In less than 2 years, the world was rid of most of what had been bedeviling it. Oddly enough, the country where the movement began was the last to succumb completely. Or perhaps it is not so odd. Coffin maker to the world, the American casket industry had by now almost completely automated box-making and grave-digging, with some interesting assembly lines and packaging arrangements. There still remained the jobs of management and distribution. The president of General Mortuary, an ebullient fellow affectionately called Sarcophagus Sam, put it well. "As long as I have a single prospective customer and a single stockholder," he said, mangling a stogie and beetling his brows at the one reporter who showed up for the press conference, "I'll try to put him in a coffin so I can pay him a dividend." Finally, though, a man who thought he must be the last living human wandered contentedly about the city of Denver looking for the coffin he liked best. He settled at last upon a rich mahogany number with platinum trimmings, an automatic self-adjusting cadaver contour innerspring wherever plastic-covered mattress with a built-in bar. He climbed in, drew himself a generous slug of fine scotch, giggled as the mattress prodded him exploringly, closed his eyes, and sighed in solid comfort. Soft music played as the lid closed itself. From a building nearby, a turkey buzzard swooped down, cawing in raucous anger because it had let its attention wander for a moment. It was too late. It clawed screaming at the solid cover, hissed in frustration, and finally gave up. It flapped into the air again, still grumbling. It was tired of living on dead small rodents and coyotes. It thought it would take a swing over to Los Angeles, where the pickings were pretty good. As it moved westward over parched hills, it espied two black dots a few miles to its left. It circled over for a closer look, then grunted and went on its way. It had seen them before. The old prospector and his burrow had been in the mountains for so long the buzzard had concluded they didn't know how to die. The prospector, whose name was Adams, trudged behind his burrow towards the buildings that shimmered in the heat, humming to himself now and then, or addressing some remark to the beast. When he reached the outskirts of Denver, he realized something was amiss. He stood and gazed at the quiet scene. Nothing moved, except some skinny pack rats and a few sparrows foraging for grain among the unburied coffins. "Tarnation," he said to the burro. "Martians?" A half-buried piece of newspaper fluttered in the breeze. He walked forward slowly and picked it up. It told him enough so that he understood. "They're gone, Evie," he said to the burro. "All gone." He put his arm affectionately around her neck. "I reckon it's up to me and you again. We got to start all over." He stood back and gazed at her with a mild reproach. "I sure hope they don't favor your side of the house so much this time."
So, we come up on our last show for the evening, another episode of the Inner Sanctum. It turns out that there was a reason that the Inner Sanctum, with its creaking door, ran so very long. It was pretty good. Tonight, we're going to go back to November the 5th of 1946 to listen to an episode called The Edge of Death. Here it comes.
Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup present Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Friends of the Inner Sanctum. Here's your host at the creaking door. Through these portals pass the world's most horrified people. Oh, what's the matter? Did my happy medium startle you? Sorry, I keep him around to get in the right spirit, you know. And now here's a little tale of horror that speaks for itself. The Edge of Death, written by Frederick Matho and starring Larry Haynes in the role of Ralph. We're going to tell you of a night Satan played a game of murder along a deserted strip of Manhattan's waterfront. For his sport, he chose two friends. For his victim, a woman. And the weapon, he suggested, he had long ago placed in the hands of another murderer. The weapon was a long, slender, graceful rapier, which first drew blood at the hand of Rasputin, the mad monk of Russia.
Denton! Denton, old friend! Open up! Denton!
Well, Fritzkin, well, come on in, man. What's the matter with you? You're soaked, no hat, no coat.
Denton! You're my best friend, my only friend. You've got to help me.
Well, I just got back from Chicago. I was going to drop over to your shop a little later.
You got back too late. You could have helped me. Now, it's too late.
Well, what's the matter, Ralph? What have you done? Well, what's that in the package? Why, it's the antique sword I gave you when you were married.
Ralph! Naked steel always looks different. Coated with blood.
Ralph, you fool. You didn't...
Yes. I just pierced a woman's heart with that rapier. About 15 minutes ago.
I warned you about your temper ever since we were kids. You almost killed me once, do you remember?
You warned me about my hobby, too. You said I had
Psychosis. That's what we psychiatrists call it. Your unnatural love of steel blades, your worship of ancient weapons and tempered steel, well, it's off balance.
There's nothing in the world more beautiful than a piece of true hand-forged steel. It's an art as old as man.
Yes, I know. We've been over all that before, but now you're a murderer. And I want to know everything that happened.
It's too late, Denton. I only
maybe,
came...
Maybe I can dig something out of you that might help your defense. Now, Ralph, close your eyes. Close your eyes and let your mind wander. Tell me the first image you get. Tell me every detail, no matter what.
I see the wedding. Here at your house. The guests have left. Ingrid is blonde and beautiful in white satin. She's standing beside me. And you'll come shortly.
Sentence. Oh, it was so good of you to make such a beautiful wedding for us. You are the best man ever.
Oh, no. Maybe the best, second best man ever. Ralph was best today.
Well, you gave me some stiff competition, then.
I've got another wedding present for you, Ralph. Mm-hmm. I waited till now to bring it out because I didn't think the others would understand.
Here, open it.
Do you like it, Ralph? Is it a good one?
This is a good one. Why, it's the most beautiful rapier I've ever seen. The balance and the lines. Magnificent steel. Look, Ingrid. Isn't it wonderful?
It will be the very nicest sword in your collection, darling. As well as your last.
His last?
Oh, yes, then. I promised Ingrid no more auctions.
And he'll keep his promise this time. I'm going to change, darling. Won't take me long.
All right, darling, hurry.
You really like that blade, don't you, Ralph?
Like it. It's beautiful. Where did you find it?
Well, I saw it yesterday in a small, junky antique shop in the village. A little Russian fellow runs it.
Oh, did he tell you anything about the blade? I mean, where he got it?
No, but he said it was Russian. He said the hilt was black lacquer on rosewood and the steel was superior.
Wow, he said something there.
He mumbled on about wanting to get rid of it before the full moon. Something about it being an evil thing. Claimed it once belonged to Rasputin, the mad monk of Russia.
Say, I wonder if it did.
I doubt it. Anyhow, he finished by saying that whoever owned it would have evil luck, and failing to get rid of it before the full moon would die by violence. I'll take it back to him if you like, Ralph.
No, not on your life, then. But don't mention that nonsense to Ingrid, will you?
I remember all that myself, Ralph. I left for Chicago that night. Now, what's the next thing that comes to your mind as important?
Well, about 3 weeks ago, I was working on some knives in the shop. Ingrid had left. I was alone. The shop door opened, and she was there.
She? Who, Ralph?
Stasha. She was beautiful, tall, white as marble, dressed in black, and beautiful.
I beg your pardon. What did you say?
Oh, I'm sorry.
You said beautiful. There's no cause to be embarrassed. I have heard this said before.
What can I do for you, Miss
Kostov? Stasia Kasov, you own something that I would like to buy.
Oh, what is it?
A rapier. A Russian rapier. I saw it in your window as I passed.
It's not for sale.
Oh, really? Are you sure? I will pay you well. Say, $100.
Sorry.
Very well. Perhaps you might change your mind. Here is my card. Come and see me if you do.
Well, thanks, but I...
Shall we say before the next full moon, Ralph?
Ralph, if it weren't for that blood-stained rapier on the table, I'd say you were lying. How could this woman know your name or anything about the legend of the rapier?
I know how.
What happened then, Ralph?
I've handled steel all my life. I've forged it, pounded it, tempered it, ground it to razor edge, and I've never cut myself. After Stasha left, I put the rapier to the stone. And as I worked, I kept seeing her eyes in the forge fire, glinting with evil beauty. I kept hearing her voice.
Ralph, shall we say before the full moon?
I turned suddenly to see if she was there, and I tripped. The rapier fell, and I fell against the upturned point.
Ralph! Ralph! Ralph, what's happened? Ralph!
I'm all right. Pull it out. Straight out.
Oh, no. No, I can't do that.
All right, I'll do it then. I'll do it.
Oh. Ralph, your arm is all blood.
It's not bad. It just tears with flesh. Call Dr. Bird.
Oh, those stupid knives. Why don't you get rid of them?
Well, England phoned. They cut to me, but that means certainly that my fate was tied to Stasha Kasov's. That death was lunging at us with Rasputin's rapier, and I was unarmed. I told Ingrid about the woman. I told her about Stasha's offer of $100 for the blade. I shouldn't have.
And to turn down $100 for it? Ralph, that's the limit.
Ingrid, I can't expect everyone to understand some things about my character, but I do expect you to try.
I think I do understand, Ralph. I think you didn't want to sell that thing because you want that woman to come back.
That was your first quarrel, Ralph?
Yes. There were lots more. Things got worse. We quarreled a lot. It wasn't Ingrid's fault. I was changing. I kept thinking of Stasia. Her eyes mocked me. I tore up a card in anger, but I'd memorized the address. It was an old Dutch mansion on Lytton Street. I had to see her again. There was a light in the house. And oddly enough, the front door was open a bit. I rang a long time, but no one answered. I obeyed an impulse and walked in. There was a coal fire going in the high-ceilinged living room. It cast dancing shadows on a life-sized oil painting above. A cold hand gripped my heart when I saw that painting. It was the painting of a man in a monk's habit. And his gnarled hand rested on the hilt of a jeweled rapier of exquisite beauty.
Yes, the man in the picture is long dead. But his mad spirit is in this room. It laughs from within you, Ralph Witkun. It has seized your body.
Stasia.
So the Kasov woman convinced you that the spirit or the ghost of Rasputin had taken possession of your body. And you fell for it.
Oh, I fought against believing it, Denton. But it did explain so many of the strange promptings that had been stirring me all up inside.
Did she say anything more about it?
No. I turned to face her. She was a smiling column of white beauty, sheathed in black satin. Miss Kasov, how is...
Stasia. Call me Stasia.
How is it you know my name? What do you know about the rapier?
Does it matter? You have changed your mind, perhaps, about selling me your rapier?
No, I came to ask you about it.
Oh, you came because you are confused. We will discuss it. But first, let us have some tea. Yes?
I examined the room while she was out of it. On the wall across from the fireplace were five oil paintings. All of them portraits of men. At first, I thought the light was playing tricks. It wasn't. Each face was painted with closed eyes. Each was a study in sleep. Or death.
You like my painting? Come and sit down. We'll have tea and talk.
Who are those men you painted, Stasia?
The five men you see in those paintings each own the rapier you now possess.
Good Lord. Then they're...
dead.
And the dates on the paintings?
Those are the dates on which they died, Rolf. Each on a day of the full moon. Each kept the rapier beyond the time he should have. More tea?
Stasia's eyes were eager and wide. My ears began to ring. I recall setting the cup down. I remember Stasia's voice a long way off.
Crossing seas from my prison and saw a Russian legend.
This is all so fantastic, Ralph. Are you sure it wasn't something you dreamed?
Something I dreamed? No, she drugged me. It was no dream. Those portraits were no dream. The painting of Rasputin was no dream. They were there when I woke. Stasio was gone. The fire was on. My head ached. There was an easel near the lamp. It hadn't been there before. I shuffled toward it. There was a fresh painting on the easel. I stared at the face before me. Its eyes were closed in sleep. The face was mine. There was a date painted in them. It was January 15th. Yes, that's tonight. I couldn't find Stasia, so I dashed out of the house, cursing like a madman. It was 4 a.m. when I reached home. Ingrid was waiting for me. She was crying.
Ralph, darling, where have you been?
Why? What difference does it make?
You've been to see that Kossoff woman.
Yes, I've been to see that Kossoff woman. Oh. I had to. I'm losing my mind, Ingrid. Something's trying to kill me. That woman knows about it. She knows how and when it'll happen. And the funny thing is, I don't care anymore. I don't care.
Ralph, where are you going?
Back to the shop. Back to that cursed rapier. In the shop, I tried to reason the thing out. I was toying with the rapier. It was a tiny green speck on a black hilt. Idly, I picked at it with my thumbnail, and a chip of lacquer snapped off. The hilt was supposed to be wood. But here, it was what looked like a large emerald. My heart pounding, I chipped and picked at the lacquer until bit by bit I uncovered the most dazzling and richly wrought collection of jewels I'd ever seen. Set in solid gold were pearls, rubies, emeralds, and a magnificent star sapphire. This was the bejeweled blade that Rasputin held in his hand in Stasia's painting. This was Rasputin's ring. I returned to Stasia's house. Like the first night, the door was ajar. Like the first night, I walked in. I walked into the living room. I looked about. Nothing had changed. Nothing, that is, except that mine was the sixth painting, now hung beside the others. And the easel already had a fresh canvas. Stasia was already painting a new portrait. The face was indistinct, but the date was clear. 1 lunar month from tonight. I gave up and walked home with the rapier under my arm. It was drizzling and foggy along the waterfront, and I was sick inside. I kept hearing Stasia's voice locked in my brain.
Tonight is the last night you may own the rapier, Ralph. But there is a way out.
A way out? How? There's no way out as long as either of us live.
There is a way out, Ralph. Kill her and come to me. Tonight is the night of the full moon, Ralph. If I own the rapier, you will be safe. Kill her, Ralph. Kill her and come to me.
Somebody's following me. A woman. I could hear her high heels on the cobblestones. I'd just passed that little blind alley. You know, the one about a block away from my shop. I decided to trick her. I stopped short. I spun around and caught sight of a woman in black as she darted into the alley. It was Stasia. And there was no exit from that alley. I tiptoed to the entrance and leaped into its shadows. All I could see was a large empty carton against the far wall. She had to be behind that. I gripped the jeweled handle of the rapier until it burned my hand. Only one searing thought in my tired mind. Stasia must die. I took a deep breath. and drew the needle-pointed steel back, aimed at where I judged a heart to be, and thrust.
Oh.
I drew the blade out, and the body slumped forward. I lit a match to see her face. But it wasn't Stasya Karsov I had killed. It was Ingrid. My wife. Ingrid.
It worked, Stasya, it worked. My plan worked. Ralph reacted just as I planned it.
You mean he did it? Killed her?
A psychological masterpiece. He told me the whole story at my office 10 minutes ago. He killed her thinking it was you.
So now that she is gone, you are happy. You will love me and forget her then.
Oh, perfect, perfect. She picked that stupid fool instead of me. Now she's dead and he'll die too.
Oh, Denton, I am so glad. I would do anything
Everything
for you.
Went like clockwork. This rapier I found in your attic, the legend I made up, the phony paintings of former owners, your flirtation, perfect, perfect. The perfect murder, I've done it.
Did my acting please you, Denton?
Oh, you were magnificent, but there's only one weakness to my plan, Stasya.
What is it?
When Ralph is picked up, there must be no way for anyone to find out that you and I know each other, Stasya. Oh,
no, and no one will know, darling.
Ralph's fingerprints are still on this rapier. He'll be electrocuted for one murder. Might as well be for two.
Denton. No. I love you.
I'm sorry, Stasya.
I love you. I will wait for you.
Very neat stroke, Denton.
Ralph!
I heard everything you said, Denton. But I didn't have to, I knew. Now, don't move. The gun is faster than a rapier.
How did you know, Ralph? Something I said tonight?
No. No, something I saw. Stasya loved you. The painting I saw on her easel tonight, the one I told you she'd begun, was your portrait. The only way I knew was because, as an artist, she was conscious of the scar on your forehead. She painted that in first.
The scar you gave me as a kid. Oh, you've a lot more brains than I gave you credit for, but at least we'll burn together.
Sorry, Denton. I'll have to decline that honor.
Oh, Ralph, am I too late?
Ingrid. Ingrid, no, you're dead. Ralph. Everything you told me at my house tonight was a lie.
No, Denton. Your plan almost worked. I told you the truth. Except for the part about murdering Ingrid.
You should have studied psychiatry, Ralph.
I did, Denton. I had a good teacher. You.
Are we going home soon, darling?
Uh-huh.
You seem so far away, Ralph. Is anything wrong?
No. No. I've been thinking about Denton. Odd the way things turned out. He made up that story about the rapier and its belonging to Rasputin and its owners dying on the night of the full moon.
You don't believe it, do you?
No. But what he thought was a cheap blade turns out to be a priceless treasure. It matches the one Rasputin held in his hand in the painting.
That was coincidence, darling. Come on, now put your work away. Let's go home. It's late.
Mm-hmm.
Such a beautiful night, Ralph. Let's walk home.
All right. You know that painting Stasya started of Denton, the one that gave his plot away?
Yes.
It had a date on it. I wonder what ghostly hand guided her brush as she wrote that date.
Why?
The date she wrote was today's. There's a full moon. And tonight was the night Denton was electrocuted.
Well, wouldn't you say that's a story which gets down to fine points? Mm-hmm. Happy ending, too. Yes, you get a ghost-to-ghost hookup between Stassi and Denton. And Ralph and Ingrid get an Exhibit A worth a few bucks and go back to the old grind.
Well, I'm glad Denton's plot didn't work.
Yes, Mary, but if it had, Ralph would have had a plot of his own, you know, in a cemetery. After all, that's one of the best-selling plots I know of.
Nonsense, Mr. Host. If you think that's the kind of thought we want to leave our Lipton listeners with, you're quite wrong. Here's a much better thought for folks to carry away with them. Tomorrow, when you visit the grocer's, get a package of Lipton tea. Buy it, try it, and see if you don't agree that Lipton's brisk flavor gives you extra enjoyment. Oh, yes, there's a great treat in store for you when you first taste Lipton's full-bodied, zestful goodness. Ask your grocer for a package of Lipton tea tomorrow.
And now, friends, in case you're wondering, we do have a moral for tonight's story. It's short and sharp. Knife can be beautiful if you keep your temper. And look out for people with an axe to grind. They may be trying to get ahead of you. Oh, by the way, this month's Inner Sanctum mystery novel is The Pavilion by Hilda Lawrence. And next week, the makers of Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup bring you another grisly Inner Sanctum tale, directed by Hyman Brown, entitled The Confession. And now, if you'll excuse me, I have an appointment with Stasia and Denton. Yes, they've got the concession for hand-forged hinges where it's hotter than the hinges of... Until next Tuesday, then. Good night. Pleasant dreams?
Well, I said that this would be the final episode, and I guess I meant it. You can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. That's night transmissions, one word, no space between the night and the transmissions. I'll say it one more time, nighttransmissions@gmail.com. Not that anybody ever writes. I wish you would. I've been thinking about setting up a wiki or some kind of website for the show. I don't know if anyone's interested, though. It would be a place where you could download the current episode and maybe even the archives of old shows. And if I did that, I would include some support material. Sometimes these old programs are based on stories that are in the public domain and are available in electronic editions that I could post there and you could download. Just something I'm thinking about. Anyway, this is Gary Clinton. You've been listening to Night Transmissions. Good night. Good day. See you next time.